Preston Hughes is a prisoner. If Texas has its way by the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Hughes by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, and Mike Gillespie. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Gloria Rubeck. Houston Vigil reporter, Nancy Bailey. Additional reporting by Dave Atwood. The execution watch for Preston Hughes begins.
You're listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFD HD3 channel. You're also listening via the internet on kpft.org, the appropriate selection thereon, and executionwatch.org. My name is Ray Hill. We only do this show whenever they have an execution in Huntsville, although we did one when they had an execution in Virginia one time. The rest of them are all Texas executions. All of these shows are archived on executionwatch.org if you wish to follow them at a later time. Tonight they are scheduled the execution of Preston Hughes, and the first thing that we do is we check to see if we have a report from Huntsville. Push that button and this button. Lori, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's going on there?
Fortunately, a lot of protesting and no executions so far.
Really?
Well, there's still appeals pending. And Alan, why are you down here and not up there?
Because we have, if there is
execution, we have. Oh. Alan Turner from the Chronicle is down here with us, so I was curious why he was walking around.
Yeah, well, Alan may not be desirous of or going into the execution chamber.
Well, he said they have another reporter that could go in if he doesn't go back up there. He's talking with Ward Larkin, who's been helping Preston Hughes file some pro se petition.
Okay, I knew he was looking for Ward.
Yes, he was. But so far, I mean, it's 6 o'clock, and the media hasn't crossed the street. Preston's mom is going to witness the execution if it does happen. But how in the hell can they execute somebody when they haven't tested DNA? And the HPD crime lab screwed up the serology, and Michael Bromwich, who was appointed to oversee the fiasco with the crime lab, specifically listed Preston Hughes' case as one that should be re-examined. And they haven't. They didn't re-examine it. So they should. So if this execution takes place, it will be a bigger crime than the usual crimes that go on here in Huntsville.
Well, right now we need to explain to the audience what it means when the witnesses do not cross the road. And would you take time to do that?
Sure. The family and friends of the person to be executed are housed in the prison administration building on 11th Street. Across the street on 12th Street is the Walls Unit, or the Huntsville Unit, commonly known as the Walls, where the death house is located. So we know if an execution is happening because we see the media representatives walking across the street, and then we see the family or friends walking across the street. It is 3 minutes after 6. And nobody has walked across the street yet, and the Chronicle reporter is down here talking to us.
Normally, they would have crossed the streets by now.
The media usually goes in about 2 minutes before 6, or else right at 6, and this hasn't happened.
Well, let me explain to the audience what happens now is we break into a breaking news story mode. And we have somebody going and examining what's going on, and I suspect Elizabeth is doing that now, to see if they can find through the Attorney General's office or through the court clerk's office what is happening that is resulting in the delay. And so the question we have is this going to happen or is it not? We have been there before, and the last time we were here, we went off the air at 7 o'clock. There had been no action, and then sometime after 10 o'clock, there was action, and the person was executed. Other times we've been here, we went off at 7 o'clock, and there was no action, and we later found out that a durable stay had been issued, and they just run out of business time to take care of it, so it was postponed. When that happens, that doesn't mean they're just pending to start tomorrow with a new execution date. That means they got to go through the whole process again.
Exactly. And one of the appeals that's pending is appealing their decision to not do DNA testing. They denied DNA testing, which I think is terminal and idiotic, but that's Texas. So that's one of the appeals pending. I'm not sure what the others are. But I do want to let your listeners know that instead of the usual 10 or 15 people that are out here, there are an additional about 20 people with us tonight from Straight Jesuit High School in Houston.
Yeah, we understand that Dave's up there with a bunch of high school kids, and we'll be talking to him later in the show.
Oh, did Dave get here? Oh, he must have just gotten here. Yeah, so it's great to have all these young people here and let them experience firsthand. You know, the mother is sitting in there waiting and hoping that child is going to live.
Oh, by the way, Gloria, yesterday's execution, which was covered in Huntsville by Professor Longmire, because you were on sabbatical, and Professor Longmire, and there was some question as to whether family was there, his brother was there. And after the show, now for two execution watches in a row, I got a call from the family, the whole family, wherever they were. Those that were not there in Huntsville heard the show in live broadcast on executionwatch.org last night.
Oh, wow.
And that adds a whole new dimension to what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Well, we love you. Keep us posted. If anything happens, let Elizabeth know in real time.
I will, and I just turned around, and Alan Turner is still down here, so I have a feeling they will be calling him if the execution is going to proceed anytime soon. We may be here, you know, till midnight, and then they have to call it off. Who knows? But hopefully there won't be an execution, because there's a very good chance this man is going to.
Okay, Gloria.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's see what's going on in Houston. So I want to go here. No, the next one, three. This way. Hello.
Hi there, Ray.
Nancy, where are you?
Well, I'm on the corner of Alameda and Holcomb.
Okay, you're out at the convent.
Yes.
And what kind of crowd you got?
Well, we're actually pretty good, considering people are at other places. Tonight we got 10 people.
That's a pretty good crowd for a brisk Thursday night.
And some people are at the Grace event, and we still got 10. Well, that's pretty good.
That is wonderful. Please give them all of our response. At this point, Nancy, you can give the folks good news that no one has come out of the administration building and crossed the road.
Okay.
So, effectively, this execution is on stay. We have no way of knowing at this point how long the stay will last.
So, nobody's come out of the administration building and gone into...
If the witnesses have not crossed 12th Street, there is a stay in place that prevents this from proceeding.
Okay. Well, that's good news. I hope it is a good stay.
Well, we hope it is, too. Give our regards to the other vigilants, and somebody will let you know if we get any different news.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was, of course, Nancy Bailey, who is with Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. That's TC AADP.org. And Gloria Ruback, who was on earlier, is with the Abolition Movement, and that's abolitionmovement.org. Put Jim on. Jim, what's going on here?
Let me talk to you a little bit about what's currently pending. I just got word the Supreme Court's acted. Well, there are five or six different things pending now. One of them is a cert appeal from the Court of Criminal Appeals that was filed today. The lawyers also filed a subsequent writ directly in the Supreme Court. Those two, I just got word a moment ago, have both been denied by the U.S. Supreme Court. So if there is not a stay, it's more of going to be a delay because Supreme Court, both of those requests were for stay, and the Supreme Court has denied both of those at this current time. That's just about 2 minutes ago. Then there's a lawsuit pending on the civil lawsuit pending on the suing the police lab. They've also got a lawsuit pending about from the civil court about using the drug cocktail in one drug as opposed to three drugs. That is still pending, and I presume a district court judge perhaps could do something, but probably not.
Well, and let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You and I have been doing this for a while, and at the very last minute, there's something like playing chicken with one side headed toward another and see who's got the nerve to turn at the last minute. Meanwhile, there's somebody else not in the game that's sitting in a cell somewhere waiting to know whether they're going to be breathing for the next 2 or 3 hours.
It's a little bit more organized. Let me explain how it works. There is a clerk in the Supreme Court. Everybody's nicknamed the death penalty clerk.
Yeah.
And what he does, the last 30 days before an execution anywhere in the U.S., what he will do, he will give a summary of the cases to the judges on the Supreme Court, to their staff. So they're well aware 30 days in advance of every case where there's an execution pending. The last 2 weeks before the execution takes place, this clerk notifies all the parties involved what possible issues may come up and gets a memorandum from both sides on what issues will come up. That, in turn, is given to the Supreme Court staff. So what happened, they're all going to be pretty well versed, although there were some writs filed at the last minute, some certs filed at the last minute. The courts have been informed about this for a couple of weeks. It's not something brand new to them.
So they've got a professional that knows how to sort these things out.
Well, what he does, he contacts the different parties, gets what their viewpoints are, what they're going to file. Then he will give a memorandum. And remember, a judge isn't just a judge. He's got a big staff that works with him, a briefing attorneys and stuff, and all of them are briefed on this stuff. So although it may be some last-minute stuff done, and none of this is going to surprise the court because they know, well, they're already prepared for it. They start preparing within a couple of months before it even occurs. So it's, although it may be last-minute motions, they're going to be ready for them.
So, and that's some of the stuff that's going on now.
Right.
But the current outstanding issue is the Houston Crime Lab stuff. Has this guy ever had another date? Is this his first date?
First one that I'm aware of. He had his case reversed earlier, but then they changed their mind on a motion for rehearing. To my knowledge, this is his first one, I think, isn't it, Elizabeth? His very first. I don't know of a stay prior to this.
I don't. And we've been doing this almost for 5 years, mm-hmm. and I don't remember his name showing up before.
I don't recall a stay before.
But even if he doesn't have a date, there's some appellate process going on that could have made the earlier.
Well, the appellate process is dead because the Supreme Court's already denied that. There are cases pending in different district litigation that perhaps could. I'm not sure they're going to go against the Supreme Court, though. We don't know the answer to that at that point.
Yeah.
Because the appellate stuff. The Supreme Court's already denied that.
Okay, anything dealing with the trial in the case. Now, what happened in this case?
Well, interesting enough, this started out by a man looking for his wife. His wife was missing. And I've had a couple of wives. I've always been happy when they were missing. But nonetheless, he wanted to find her. Well, anyway, and the same way speaks probably for the wives. If husband's missing, they're probably pretty happy about
it. Yeah, I appreciate you repeating, Elizabeth. You got the microphone.
I had to get the female version in on this. Anyway, this guy looking for his wife around 11:30 at night flagged down a couple of policemen. And it's a Fuddruckers over in the western part of Houston. And he said his wife was missing. They started looking. But when they were looking, they were talking to this man. A man came running up and said there are two bodies out in this vacant lot because there's a vacant lot next to Fuddruckers. The police go out there and they find a 15-year-old girl. Her name is Chandra Charles. And she was bleeding pretty badly. Then they found a dead 3-year-old child there by the name of Marcel Taylor. And he was already dead. And so some more police were summoned, and what happened, they asked Chandra, who was bleeding profusely at the time, asked her what happened, and she said, what she said is, Prestrin tried to rape me. That's all she said. She could barely whisper that, but she did get that out. And this was around 11:30 at night. So what the police did at that point, they go to an apartment complex next door to an apartment manager, and they find somebody by the name of Preston. And they start knocking on Preston Hughes' door at 2:30. So the bodies are found around 11:30 or somewhere around midnight. By 2:30, they're knocking on his front door. He answers the door, and they talk to him briefly and ask him if he'd come to the police station with them. And he agreed to do so. They didn't discuss why or anything. He didn't ask a lot of questions. And while we're there, they saw a hunting knife in the apartment, and what they later claimed that when they answered the door that was dark, they also claimed they saw a pair of glasses. He goes down to the police station, and he admits knowing this lady. Now, once they get him to the police station, get his ID, they run him through their computers and discover that he's on probation for sexual assault, that he has a record of being a sexual offender. So then they perk up, and the next thing they find out, he admits knowing Chandra. He admitted that he knew her, had knew her from living around the apartment. And so at that point, because she called his name, because he lived in close proximity, because he admitted knowing her, at that point they arrest him and Mirandize him. Then they question him further. By 4:30, he tells story number one. Story number one was that he had been threatened earlier and started carrying a knife, and that he was going through a vacant lot, and this woman tapped him on the shoulder. He grabs his knife and turns around and starts stabbing. Then he realizes it's Chandra. And that's what he said first time. Then he gave a second confession. In the second confession, he claims that he is going through the lot and he bumps into Chandra and tells this bizarre story that Chandra was on her way to his apartment to borrow his contact lens. I never heard of anybody bearing contact lens, but that's what she claimed he did. And then they talk about the contact lens, and then he says that she begins to rub him provocatively, and that thereafter, the court opinion is kind of nice about it, said there's some sexual activity takes place, and then said it wasn't satisfactory to him. And she wanted money, according to him, and he denied, would not give her any money. And he claimed, she said, if you don't pay me some money, I'll claim you raped me. And then he claims that she slapped him, and then he starts stabbing her in response. And then he said the three-year-old started crying, came between them, and he stabbed and killed the three-year-old. That's what he said in his two different confessions. And that's pretty much what the case amounted to, is his confessions plus what she had to say. And later on, there was some DNA. They found some little bit of DNA evidence connecting to some of the clothing, but that was pretty much the case, his confessions.
And the case was tried in Harris County?
Absolutely. Alice McCullough represented him. You know Alice,
I think. Yeah, sure. And Alice capable of trying.
Sure.
Because you're without any trouble. Why wasn't there more blood? I mean, according to one thing that I read, he cut major arteries and veins in the neck.
Here's what's interesting. They claimed he cut the carotid and aorta both on both children. And what was one of the more things, Susan's going to discuss some of the aspects that makes it innocent, and I'd like Susan to talk about that because she's the one that's kind of prepared that, what made it look like maybe perhaps the argument that he's innocent. Susan?
Susan, what happened to the blood?
Well, we don't know. Essentially, there was a short time frame between when the body was found, which was around 11 o'clock, and police went to his apartment about 2:30 in the morning. So it was a fairly short, not a very long time frame, a fairly short time frame. When police went to his apartment, they did not find any blood evidence on his clothing or in his apartment. And
The hunting knife?
They found the hunting knife, but they were not able to get blood evidence from the hunting knife, of her blood.
You can't just wash that stuff off of a knife.
This is like an issue where there you would have to essentially hire an expert, perhaps a medical expert that could testify or give an expert opinion as to those type of injuries, how blood would come out, where blood would maybe spatter on him or squirt on him, because obviously this was the aorta and the carotid artery.
They didn't find any clothes with any significant amount of blood on
them? No, no. There's no evidence that they found any blood at his apartment.
What about the viability of someone having those two veins and arteries cut? Being able to speak to police with any degree of reliability.
That is another issue that some people have questioned, as is it possible for someone that had injuries that were that severe to be able to speak? Obviously, somebody with those type of injuries, from the time they're injured, you would think that they would, shall we say, die very soon. In other words, the time frame can't be very long from the injury to their death. And so there's obviously some question, some people have questions as to whether or not she'd be able to speak. And once again, that would be something that a medical expert would be able to analyze the injuries, you know, the size, perhaps the size of the 15-year-old girl, and give an opinion on it. But there was no expert, was not hired, and none was called at trial.
In the trial.
Let me add something to that, right? What had happened in some of the writ proceedings afterwards, in some of the appeals afterwards, the writ lawyers hired a forensic pathologist out of Fort Worth who testified pretty conclusively. He had reviewed the autopsy report, and he said there's no way in the world with those type of injuries that a person could speak, almost to be some immediately, because of blood gushing out and losing air. The only thing that kind of hurts that argument, somebody called out Preston's name, they wouldn't want to go to the apartment. I mean, that's
well,
the problem.
Well, if that happened today, I mean, like, hello, this is 2012. If that happened today, when they went to that Fuddruckers, the computer in that car would show the residence of every registered sex offender within a mile, instantly.
But they didn't.
But
have
this
it
is
then.
23 years ago, right. And I don't even know if they had computers in cars 23 years ago. And they were just communicating with walkie-talkies.
Well, at this point, they wouldn't know she'd even been looking for a sexual offender. All they had was a woman bleeding at the neck.
Yeah, but if you put in that address, right. I don't care what the crime is, if you put in that address, a map pops up on the screen. I ride around squad cars a lot, usually in the back seat. But I can see I can see the computer from there, and you put an address in the computer, you're going to get how to get there, and as you get there, it's going to show the area. And
see, that was one of the arguments made by some of the people who say that they think there's claims of innocence that they would have known ahead of time, but back then I'm not sure that's true.
23 years ago, I don't think they had the technology to do that. And so that's a leaving pending. Well, I'm going to break from this discussion and put on Dave Atwood as soon as the line starts flashing again, because Elizabeth's talking to him, and she has to stop talking and it start flashing. But as soon as that flashes, let me know, so just to keep me from staring at the telephone. So is there in anybody who's looked at this case mind any question about guilt or innocence?
Let's talk about the punishment part. Maybe that would be appropriate, Susan.
Well, Kate, he had a previous case of an aggravated sexual assault of a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah.
That was in 1985. After he assaulted the girl, he threatened her not to essentially go to the police. However, she did go to the police. And then when the case went to court and was being prosecuted, he threatened her again and fired a gun in her direction. And, of course, she reported that as well. And so he ended up being on probation for the aggravated sexual assault of the 13-year-old girl and the aggravated assault firing the gun in her direction.
And that got him probation? Not
deferred.
Deferred.
He got probation. He also had a case where he was on probation for a sexual assault out of New York. And that was basically his, you know, so he was, in other words, police would, when police checked and looked for the name of, look for Preston at the nearby apartment complex, they also checked for sexual convictions or offenses, and that's what they found.
Okay, David is now available, and so we're going to go, David, push that button and then this button. Dave, are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
Well, you're out of place. You're in Huntsville instead of around here.
Yeah, I know.
Has anyone crossed the road?
No, nobody's crossed the road yet.
So this case is in suspense until something happens that we don't know about.
Right, right. So I don't know what we've got quite a big, relatively big group up here, but nobody has crossed over yet.
Okay, and who have you got in the form of students from Jesuit?
Well, a teacher at Straight Jesuit, John Fay, brought up 20 students today from that high school, Straight Jesuit High School in Houston, and he's very willing to talk to you about everything that he's working on.
Okay, well, put him on the air, and we'll talk to him.
All righty. Ray Hill, KPFD.
Hello?
Is this John Fay?
Yeah, this is John.
Okay, John, what are you trying to do to those kids?
Well, Ray, we've got a long-standing tradition in our church and in our school of being committed to justice issues. And so these young men are members of our social justice club and our pro-life club, and we're here to give them a chance to stand up publicly and make, for most of them, their first public advocacy against the death penalty and in favor of life. We're trying to mold them into men who understand these issues and stand committed with our faith and with the basic demands of justice that that capital punishment cannot be tolerated in our state or in our nation.
Well, that sounds like a very admirable thing, and you lucked out on this one because so far there has been no action to indicate that this execution is actually going to happen. So
we're very hopeful.
They're at a hinge point where they will learn a lesson of just how fragile these decisions are. This man is in a cell a few feet away from the execution chambers. They can open and close the doors and actually see into the room that they intend to take him and kill him. And he's in suspense about a process that by statute began at 6 o'clock and presumably will end at 12 o'clock today. If he survives that long, they will have to go through the whole process again, set him another date and all of that.
Right.
And my friends who work in Texas prison say that if we don't get the go-ahead before 10 o'clock, there is no way we can get ready to do an execution.
Wow.
So his real window is between 6 o'clock, which is already passed, and 10 o'clock, for them to get word to proceed, and beyond that, then just by operation of that death chamber, he is home free until they set another date. And just the emotional, excruciating suspense of all of this. It's bad enough for us in the studio. I'm sure it's bad for you folks out there on the street. Imagine what it is like for him and a fellow human being.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I think it's very important for us to be able to bring my students to this place so that they could be, as in the moment as we can ever be, rather than keeping this issue in the abstract. Because I think that's such a key thing you just said there, Ray, that this is a human being just like us. And that I think, changes things. There's definitely a very heightened sense of awareness here right now.
Well, be sure and give our regards and express our admiration for the young men's commitment to accompany you there.
Yeah, I will do that, and thank you for your good work, too.
Thank you much. And is Dave still available?
Dave's here, yep.
Still on there? Dave?
Great.
That was a remarkable story.
Great.
And I suppose you're not an agitator in this process. You haven't helped encourage them to do this, because this is...
I've been trying to do everything I can within the Catholic Church, for many years.
And there is a rumor to that effect, and I want you to know that we genuinely appreciate you're doing the work that you do.
Well, I thank you, Ray. I appreciate it very much, and you've been at it too. So it's a joint effort by all of us, and. As we know, we're eventually going to win. We just don't know when it's going to happen.
Well, let's try to coffee up or at least spend some time talking early next week. We've got a nice recess here. This is the last scheduled execution until after the holidays.
Right.
And let's take advantage of that sabbatical.
Okay. All righty.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay. You take care. Bye-bye.
Just push the speaker button. And that was Dave Atwood. And Dave, of course, is along with Nancy Bailey, who we talked to earlier, is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And you can find out more about them and their organization with tcadp.org. You're still on?
One thing I wanted to mention, if the defense had hired a medical expert, the state would have noticed that the defense was going to call a medical expert. So the state would have also hired a medical expert. And so chances are at trial, you would have two conflicting expert opinions. So it might not have really solved anything, and it may come down to which expert was more credible or something like that. So you see what I'm saying? The state would have certainly called a medical expert if the defense did.
To argue whatever the defense medical expert had to say. How do they know what that expert witness is going to testify? Do they have to divulge that?
Well, the defense would have to, there would be notice, the state would have noticed that the defense intends to call an expert and who the expert would be, and so they would know what it's going to be about.
Yeah.
And so they would get I would call it a counter expert, and the defense would know who the counter expert is and what their qualifications are and what they're going to, more or less, what they're going to testify to.
From a conversation before we began the show, I get the impression that this defendant quarreled with his lawyers a lot. Oh, okay. We got to bring Mike Gillespie
Mike
in on this. Mike, would this have been a fun client?
I have never seen a client fight with his lawyer as much as this man has fought. I am used to having clients disagree with you. I'm used to having clients not agree with decisions on the handle of trial. But in this case, not even talking about how they fought during the trial, but recently, within the last 2 months, the lawyer filed a civil suit strictly on the issue of the three poisons versus one poison. Now, what that issue is, the question of, do you die peacefully or do you die in pain? So the lawyer filed a civil suit saying this is a wrong way to execute somebody. The client objected to it. The client filed his own papers in court, telling the court this lawyer doesn't speak for him. The client filed papers in federal court saying his lawyer doesn't speak for him. This is not the question of guilt or innocence. It's a question of how you're going to pass. And he continually fought with his client, with the lawyer, about that issue. Concerning the actual case itself, there were many issues during the case in which the client insisted on calling his trial his own way. He talked in court. He objected in court. He fought with the lawyer in court, and you can't have that in a courtroom. Somebody has got to be in charge, and it's not the client. It's got to be the lawyer.
So he's been a difficult client going back 23 years when trials began, is it?
I have never seen a case where somebody has fought so much with his attorney.
And there's a paper trail of all this.
There's a paper trail of it in the civil court and a paper trail in the criminal case about how he fought with his attorney. One of the main issues of the case in the beginning was he wanted to take the stand and explain himself. That's a decision that lawyers need to make. When a client insists on taking the stand and the lawyer doesn't want him to, you have to let the client do what he wants to do.
Well, he had the previous record, which would have been logical to keep him off the stand.
Exactly correct. Not to mention, not all clients understand how tricky cross-examination can be and how when they want to tell the truth can be twisted by a cross-examination. There's no way to prep somebody for this unless they've been through it before. You have to follow your lawyer. You have to listen to the man you trust. And that becomes a problem here. It is very difficult for an inmate to trust a court-appointed lawyer. Private lawyers get the opportunity to meet a client in his office, sit down, talk to him, arm's-length transactions. If he's not happy with the lawyer, he can talk to other lawyers. But when you're in jail and you're looking at your lawyer through bars, the lawyer is part of the people who put you here. You have no control over that client. That client is listening to writ writers in jail, listening to other people in jail telling him what his lawyer should be doing, and you don't have that ability. Not to mention, when clients are in jail, they don't have access to lawyers. If they come across a thought, they can't pick up a telephone and say, what do you think about this? They have to wait till the lawyer wants to come see him. And unfortunately, lawyers come to see clients with their own agenda. We're not always conscious that the client has an agenda. When you're a free man, you have the ability to talk with your lawyer as an equal. But when you're locked up in a cell, you don't have that ability. It makes it very, very difficult. I know in my practice, what I try to do is get as many friends and families of the client involved with the process so they trust me. And I find if the people they trust me, then they're more likely to trust me. But you don't have the opportunity in jail because they don't even have the access to the people that they trust. The big issue in this case has been called actual innocence. This client, and I'm telling you, he not only filed papers in state court over the way he was going to be executed, he filed papers in federal court trying to remove the lawyer because he freely believes he's innocent. What he doesn't understand is that the innocence issue is over. This is an appeal. There's a concept of law called actual innocence. What that means is once a jury makes a decision, it cannot be overturned unless you can prove the man is actually innocent. And you need to do that by newly discovered evidence, not the evidence that's already brought forth before the court, because the jury has determined that evidence. So even though the man really feels he's innocent...
Well, let me get this right. By the way, I need to tell folks, you're listening to Execution Watch on KPFT. .org or KPFT HD3 channel, or you're listening to this show on executionwatch.org. My name is Ray Hill. We're having a conversation here with Mike Gillespie, and Mike is trying to explain what is that issue and what has been in the issue, and the fact that this defendant, Preston Hughes, has had numerous quarrels with virtually every lawyer he had. Now, if evidence is presented at trial, the jury, and solely the jury, can decide whether that evidence is credible, believable, and decide on the matter of guilt or innocence or punishment how much of that evidence to accept or discard.
That's correct. And unfortunately, once they make that decision, you cannot revisit that.
Unless you get to a new evidence thing.
Something has to come up that was not available to the attorney at the time of the trial, and you have to go to court and prove that this is new evidence that was not newly discoverable, and it clearly shows that this man is innocent. It's a very tough burden to make.
So in this case, if there is any new evidence, it might come from the DNA testing in the lab, which is an issue in this case.
It could be an issue, but it could also be decided that this was available to the attorney at the time of trial and it wasn't explored at that time, so therefore it's not newly discovered evidence.
Oh, so if they... We know the problem with Houston Crime Lab. I mean, those people just making stuff up and carrying it to the courtroom and hoping it would stick. In other words, every prosecutor and cop in the city of Houston would go in and you will find this to be true and that to be true. And that's what they found instead of the actual science. And a lot of science going on there. And so if that, no matter what quality that investigation was, it couldn't be reexamined.
Let me talk about that a minute right there. In post-conviction writs, and they tell you this over and over again, it is virtually impossible to base a writ on actual innocence is what they use it, because you got to prove several things. You got to prove this is newly discovered evidence that was not available at time of trial or you couldn't find with diligence. If the lawyer could have found it at time of trial, it's not newly discovered evidence, as Mike said. But more importantly, it can't be just contradictory evidence that contradicts what the jury heard at trial. It's got to be conclusive. And let me give you an example of one. In fact, I've only seen maybe two or three cases on writs have been won that way. And that normally comes into play. I remember the case out of Dallas in which they granted a writ on newly discovered evidence. because what happened, the eyeball witnesses were interviewed by the DA's office because they thought there might have been something wrong with the case and discovered the police had put the witnesses up to making the identification.
Yeah, well, the Randall Dell Adams case, you had the guy who witnessed three police killings.
And so what happened, you have to have, what you basically have to have is a recantation of everything the jury heard at trial, not something that contradicts, because all the DNA evidence in this case would do would be contradict perhaps the confession. That's not going to be sufficient. It's got to be something in the sense that it's not overwhelming in the right word. It's got to be something that absolutely convinces as opposed to contradicts what had been heard before.
Okay, this conversation, it's almost impossible. This conversation between Jim Skelton and Ray Hill here. I spent some time on telephone with Anthony Graves this afternoon.
Right.
Anthony Graves was locked up for a total of 14 and a half years. He spent 12 of it on death row, and he actually didn't do it.
But was there granted on that or another grounds?
It was absolute innocence or actual innocence.
Those are tough ones to come.
Well, it came by him, and it's come by, you know, we're working on that determination in the Carrie Mack.
Did he confess in his original
problem?
Well, see, here you've got a problem. The problem you've got is if you, the newly discovered evidence has got to, if he just contradicts the confession, that's not sufficient. Because it's got to be an instance where, say, an eyeball witness says you did it and then later says, oh, the police put me up to it. You've got to absolutely destroy the state's case, present new evidence. It can't be just contradictory evidence. That's why it's so tough to
prove. No, as a matter of fact, as you get close to the release date, boy, they come in with all kinds of officers, sign this piece of paper and confess to this lesser offense and yada, yada, all this other stuff. And that's what Carrie Mack
Cook here was the big flap, though. See, what happened, Pat McCain did all the writ work. Them here later, and Pat just knew that in his opinion there's no way in the world, because everything that this gentleman wanted Pat to do had was a rehash of what had happened at trial.
Okay.
That wasn't going to work. He knew it was not going to work, so his writs were based on something other than actual innocence. And this is why, in fact, he is so angry at Pat he wouldn't even file the paupers oath, and they had the case going to the Supreme Court. He's that mad. And because Pat, I couldn't convince him that there's no way in the world he could win on an actual innocence claim. Because remember, go back again, it can't be just contradictory rebuttal evidence to what you heard at trial. It's got to over, it's got to do a complete flip-flop.
Yeah, right, sure.
And that's just like I say, and usually if you've got a confession case, you take every case that's, I guarantee you, I'll promise you that in virtually every case where you had an actual innocence, if there's been a confession that wasn't forced, they're going to say that that's going to be sufficient to convict. It's got to be something that completely destroys the state's case and proves the innocence of the defendant. That's a real tough
This case is 23 years old. So we're talking about pre-1990 is when this happened.
Right.
And that's a long time. What does anyone have any speculation as to what delayed this case this long?
Well, they had, for one thing, the trial took some length of time, and then what happened, it was initially reversed on appeal, then the motion for rehearing, they reversed what they reversed on appeal and affirmed the conviction. So it's been bouncing around the appellate court some, and there's been a lot of delays based upon getting DNA, because there was some later DNA testing done, some more things done like that, and that's the only reason I can think of. And then we have another big issue that was brought up that may be the delay is the fact they have changed the protocol for executing somebody, and that may be one of the problems. There's a delay here because the protocol has been changed.
Sure, protocol has been changed. Yeah.
And Larry's going to talk
about
that.
Larry's going to talk about it. Swing the microphone around to Larry, and while you're doing that, I'll remind people you're listening to Execution Watch on KPFT HD3 channel, and then we're also available on kpft.org with the appropriate search of the information there, and we're listening to it on executionwatch.org. I'm Ray Hill, and Larry Douglas is going to talk about the cocktail problems. What you got, Larry?
Well, just a couple of things before I begin talking about that, Ray, and that is that Preston Hughes pretty much decided what his defense theory ought to have been, and he didn't care what the lawyer said. So all through his position has been that he was innocent, that the police illegally searched his apartment, and that they planted the evidence on him. And so he was totally dissatisfied with all of his lawyers all the way through. Now on the cocktail, as you know, for the last few months, the cocktail has been used. Before that, there was a cocktail of three drugs being used to execute people. One, to anesthetize, to knock out the pain. Another, to slow down the breathing until it stops, and then one to shut down the heart. Those drugs were in sometimes short supply due to lots of different efforts. And so what happened was the Department of Criminal Justice decided, despite the statute, decided that we can execute people just using the one drug. And so there has been some controversy over this to the point that Pat McCain decided that, well, since the courts looked at this before, what I can do is go to the civil court. And so what Pat did is he filed a lawsuit against the executive director of the Department of Criminal Justice, yeah, and the director of the criminal the institutional division, saying that trying to prevent them from using the drug, saying the protocol was not acceptable. But in order to do that, in order to file the civil suit, on the criminal side, when the fight was going on between Preston Hughes and his lawyers, there are certain things lawyers have to decide in the criminal case, and certain things that the client can decide. Now, the client has the right to a trial by jury. Mm-hmm. So in ordinary, not in a capital murder case, if there's going to be a jury anyway, yeah, but pretty much the right to a trial by jury, who does the punishment, judge, a jury, that's in most cases, and whether or not to take the witness stand. Other than that, the decisions are the lawyer's decision. That's inside the criminal case. What Pat decided to do, and I can't say enough good things about the lawyers who do this kind of work, but Pat took a fairly risky step in filing a civil suit over his client's objection.
Now, this whole issue of what the chemicals are used to kill you, this now has been going on for some months.
Correct.
We've done several of these shows where they use a single drug instead of a cocktail of drugs.
Right.
Is this the first time in Texas this issue has been raised?
Not the first time the issue has been raised. This is the first time that I'm aware of that some lawyer has gone to a civil court
to raise it.
To raise the issue, but he's doing so without the consent of his client, which is actually required to file. This is the lawsuit is styled Preston Hughes versus,
yeah,
those two gentlemen from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. So that would require Preston Hughes.
I think we have a
consent.
Report. I think we have a report from somewhere. What have we got?
Yeah, I spoke with Gloria, and nothing much is happening, but she's going to give you an update of some things she's heard.
Gloria, what's going on up there?
Well, we just got some bad news. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has denied DNA testing. So they apparently think it's okay to murder somebody even though the evidence isn't tested. There are two legal things pending. One is a lawsuit against Niece Parker, and the other is against a lawsuit against Reese Owens and the Board of Pardons. But it's unlikely that either of those would hold up an execution. So I'm in, and this is according to Alan Turner. He said that the CCA had denied the DNA testing motion. And that they did call you? What'd they say? Okay, the Court of Criminal Appeals just called Ward Larkin and said they affirmed the trial court's decision to let it stand. So they're not going to do anything. So I would do you anticipate, Ward, that we're going to see the witnesses start crossing? Yeah, I think so. So I think we're going to have an execution.
Well, we have held, this is now, it's now 6:50. The show goes off the air in 10 minutes, regardless of what happens.
As soon as I see somebody, I will give Elizabeth a call. But
Just skip the middle thing and go straight to, you've got to call Elizabeth because it's the only way we can get you on the air.
Right, because you're not on the air,
right,
per se.
Yeah.
Okay, you're on the computer.
You're on the computer.
HD3 or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll call you as soon as I see some action up there.
Gloria, well, I really appreciate you being this diligent on that, and give everybody my regards. I knew Alan wasn't getting it on the phone. He doesn't like to be part of the story. He just wants to report it in the Chronicle in the morning.
Right, and I was teasing him because he was holding my sign while I was calling Ward.
Take a picture of that. We'll blackmail him.
I said, I'm going to put you on Facebook with that sign. He says,
Well, so, there's no sense in blackmailing. He doesn't make any more money than we do, so it's not going to do us any good.
So he says, I'm supposed to be impartial. I said, how can you be impartial to murder? I
don't want to hear all your arguments with Alan. Those have been going on for several decades now.
Okay.
I love you and thank you for your diligence.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that was Gloria. And Gloria is up there being a vigilant and doing what vigilants do. So where are we with this cocktail thing? The civil court, civil suit is not going to probably stop anything.
Well, the civil suit is not going to go anywhere because judges are notorious for only doing what they have to do.
Yeah.
So if you've got a case before you where the petitioner, plaintiffs in this case, doesn't want to proceed, then the judge doesn't have to decide the case. The judge told the lawyer, look, what you need to do is, you know, is your client on board with this? Lawyer says, well, I think that he's so afraid and he's been in prison for over 20 years, so he's probably confused. Okay, counsel, but if your client's not, if you don't give me an affidavit from your client saying he's on board with this, it's almost impossible for the judge to proceed with the case. Now, another case, if it were the case that the client was on board, then at least the judge would have had to decide. Now, whether he would have or not, what he would have decided, we don't know. And what effect it would have had in terms of the judge's power to enjoin the Texas Department of Criminal Justice from doing the execution. We don't know that either. But that is an issue that is not going to be decided because of the client's lack of cooperation.
And this is in the state district civil court.
Correct. Okay. Here in Harris County.
Okay. It's a little different matter if it's a federal district court, which has joint civil and criminal jurisdiction. You file the civil suit there, and that judge, being a federal judge, could stop the rodeo.
And I don't know specifically how much of a difference it would have made, but it's an issue that's not going to be decided.
Well, one of the reasons he might not have wanted to go to federal court is because the issue of the single drug has been tested in other state, and it has held up.
Right, right. That's a possibility,
yeah,
sure.
And that would affect it. Slip that microphone around, Jim. By the way, that was Larry Douglas, who does the billboard and has that wonderful voice.
Well, Clay Foster brought this issue up in criminal district court, and it didn't work. So that's why they went to civil court. As a matter of fact, that's one of the biggest arguments made by the
Attorney
General.
Well, it could have been filed as a civil issue in a federal district court because they have joint jurisdiction.
But they've already ruled on it.
Okay, but feds have already ruled on it.
That was a big argument. Since it's a death penalty case, it should be in the Court of Criminal Appeals or in a district court, and that's the big argument. And I don't think the judge would have ruled on it, even if Foster had gone along with it because of a jurisdictional problem. Because civil courts don't have criminal jurisdiction. This is a death penalty case, and that's the province of the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Yeah, well, Texas already ruled, and I remember in
Cleve Foster's case.
And Cleve Foster's
right,
case.
So it's already been ruled on.
I know
the
another
court.
Case where someone tried to appeal 2106 on the civil side. Mike?
The one interesting avenue that could be approached, and this is a long shot, but technically speaking, if there was more pain and suffering through this type of execution, the heirs could file a lawsuit in probate court for damages.
Hmm. Yeah, so there is some kind. Well, wait a minute. The heirs have filed a suit in the Willingham case.
But in probate court for the estate.
Yeah, I don't know what court they filed it in, but it's a civil action for the wrongful state execution of Todd Willingham, which there's now some pretty considerable evidence that was insufficient, an execution with insufficient
evidence.
But
if you can prove he went through more pain and suffering than he's supposed to, then the heirs would have the right to collect the money for his estate, and that money would be distributed to the heirs, and it would be a cause of action in probate court.
That's interesting. Susan, you had something?
No, I mean, I guess you could make the claim, but you'd have to prove it. And
you
of
have
course,
to prove it all
to
up.
You'd have to prove the claim. You'd have to, prove liability, and then you'd have to prove damages. And
how can you prove it when a man's dying, he's in pain, he can't ask him? That's a big problem. How are you going to do that?
Well, you can't prove the reverse of that either.
Right, exactly. That's a big
problem. Nobody comes back and says, oh, no, that was a snap.
Can't do it.
Well, they've gone through this process primarily because the Europeans do not like the habit we have of executing people. The original drug cocktail, part of it was made in Norway, and the Norwegians not only said it's illegal to ship this drug to the United States, but they passed criminal laws for those that facilitated it. Well, they managed to smuggle it out of Norway, and they got it to a pharmaceutical company in London, whose office, it was reported, I'm not making this up, was part of an automobile rental office. And they become the exporter to American states at a great markup, very high markup. And the states apparently flew to London, rented a car, and went next door to the car rental place and bought the drugs and brought it back to the United States and used their badges and other paraphernalia to get through customs with it. And then the supplies started running out, because that company was besieged by anti-execution people in Europe, and they closed up shop and just went back to renting cars. And so this has been a saga. It's worthy of a Shakespearean play, this drama about the drugs. Thank you, Larry, for covering the drug issue for us today. That brought up some things. Thank you, Mike, for your contribution in dealing with the quarrels with the lawyers and the appellate stuff. And Susan, thank you very much for your coverage of your part. And, of course, thanks to Jim for his work. You're listening to Execution Watch, and I'm Ray Hill. We only do this show when there is an execution. Our purpose of doing this show is to shine some light down the dark tunnel of the process of killing people judicially. And in Texas, we do that a lot. This is the 253rd execution under the direction of Governor Rick Perry. And that is about half of all of the executions under all Texas governors, going back to when we started executing people at the end of Furman. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening to KPFT HD3 channel, and good night.